Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
All righty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a really exciting founder, a founder that has been building, scaling, you know, and doing everything that you can think of with his very innovative business, you know, a real rocket ship. You know, they are doing something extremely unique and we're going to be walking through this story in detail. So I don't want to make anyone wait any longer because I think we have a very inspiring conversation ahead. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Eshar Ben Shchitrit. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Alejandro. Very happy to be here.
So originally born there in Israel, and you grew up in a kibbutz. So how was life growing up? Give us a walk through memory lane.
Kibbutz for a kid is paradise. You live in a country club. You have complete independence. You do at the age of four things that kids in a city don't do until they're 16. You have your own bike and you can ride around. You eat with the kibbutz, so you don't eat with your family. You spend time with friends and you become very independent. You become very, very confident in your ability to do whatever you want from a very young age. And you're surrounded with nature, animals, all the fun thing that you want as a kid. As a grown-up, it's more difficult because you don't have a lot of freedom, you don't have assets. It's a modern version of communism. So you might get trapped, but as a kid, it's paradise.
So I guess, you know, for you, you know, like you also experienced at a young age, you know, the whole thing, you know, the whole food, you know, industry, you know, you got into restaurants. So how was that for you?
So that was my passion. And even before that, my mother worked in the dairy farm and my father worked in the turkey farm. So I really saw this side of this industry, but I enjoyed cooking from a very young age and especially meat. From the age of nine, I started reading cooking books, especially about meat, and try to cook fancy meals to my family. And then by chance, my uncle had a restaurant in Tel Aviv, and I decided to go work there in the weekend, basically volunteer. I wasn't get paid. I did it for fun, for excitement, and to learn how to cook. And it was focused on meat. The area that I was really interested is how you elevate cooking meat to this fancy level of high-end culinary like art.
So then in your case, you know, it was very interesting, the blend that I saw on the way that you guys, or that in your case, you know, actually at a personal level, the way that you have combined finance and then also law, you know, what an interesting combination, you know, like it sounds like you were already into the whole restaurant and meat, you know, but it took you a tiny bit, you know, to get back into it. So why finance and law? Why that combination?
You know, when I interviewed to an internship as a lawyer, I had to write an essay, and my essay was that I was supposed to be a chef and actually I'm going to become a lawyer. And it's really, really, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's very Israeli. You search yourself. You don't choose one thing. You choose like experiences. And for me, studying law and studying finance was an experience. I never thought I would be a lawyer or a banker with a suit, but I thought, let's do it. Maybe I can choose my path later on. The real story behind law, I was very bad at math as a high school student. Very bad. I thought I had a problem. So I chose where I can study without doing any math. Law is the only place that you can study in Israel without doing statistics and math. And I was actually quite good in the law studies. I had good grades. And I was accepted to MBA directly. During the law studies, I also did my MBA.
So then let's talk about, you know, what happened after this, because, you know, like essentially, you know, for you, you know, you did a little bit of law clerk and, you know, another stuff, you know, in parallel. But, you know, it sounds like it was very pivotal when you ended up joining Hewlett Packard, because actually that's also where you met your co-founder. So Hewlett Packard, you know, it's quite a different, you know, thing from what you're doing today.
It sounds all over the place, right? A lawyer, then HP, then 3D printed the meat. And it's true. I'm not a person that wants to commit to something. I want to do a lot of things. And my thought process and my way of work is very, very scattered. And actually, it's by chance. Everything that I am doing in life, even Redefine Meat, it's by chance. But I think the chance has some destiny or faith behind it. as you said, I came to HP by chance, but I met my co-founder there. Actually, a very close relative of mine told me that I need to be a product manager because a product manager is a potential CEO. And he told me, I think you should become a CEO, but the journey will start from being a product manager. And then by luck, there was this advertisement in the newspaper. We're looking for product managers without experience, because you need experience, for a digital printing presses. And when I was a kid in the kibbutz, I never imagined that my career will be becoming a product manager of printing presses, industrial printing presses. But I went to an interview and I met some really smart people. And I wanted to be those people. They were very smart, very sharp, very analytic, very clear about what they need to do and how much they have passion to developing this technology for industrial printing presses. So I just did it. I finished my internship, and a day later I started working in HP. I didn't take one day off. And the best thing, a lot of things happened. I met both my co-founder and the chairman of Redefine Me there. But the best thing that happened is that Adam, my co-founder, taught me how to work in Excel. And we got bonded because I didn't know how to work in Excel before that.
So then what were the sequence of events that needed to happen for you to, take the jump, the leap of faith with Redefine Me? What needed to happen?
I'll tell you the real story. It's the first time I'm telling that because I'm hoping founders are listening to this story. I quit HP because I wanted to be a founder. And I said, I'm 30 years old. I'm in Israel. I can't be in a corporate. I need to be a founder in a company. But I didn't have any idea and any passion. I didn't put like a purpose behind that. So the first job offer that I got, I took. And then I spent 4 more years in a great company. But I wasn't a founder of a company. So it was, am I going to miss this destination? And I went to a startup and I saw that you can become a founder and you can raise money and you can work with investors and boards and customers all over the world. And it's not something that you need to be Superman to do. An average person, a mediocre person like myself, I'm not outstanding in anything, can change the world. Why? Because it's just a matter of courage. It's just a matter of understanding that everything in life is tough. Everything is a risk. Every venture that anybody ever started had a huge amount of uncertainties. And even the most successful entrepreneurs in the world, they had the guts to start and they were extremely lucky. This is what I studied in this company, Hycon, with an amazing, resilient, spiritual person that is the founder there. That impacted me to take a jump. And then when I knew what is my crusade, what is my destination, or what is the thing I'm willing to take the chance on, I quit that job and I started Redefine Me.
So tell us about, what was that moment where it became clear that, it was time for you to get going.
I started to develop an obsession, and you really need an obsession that you feel slowly takes over all of your personality. What happened in my first job in HP, I became a father and I stopped eating meat. So after 30 years of being a carnivore and passionate about meat, I stopped eating meat and I thought this is my life-changing thing. But then I became obsessed of meat alternatives. This desire of people that stopped eating meat or still eating meat to eat something that looks like meat and tastes like meat, it was my hobby. Suddenly it was my hobby. And I was very disappointed with what I was able to achieve. And I became fascinated with the possibility first that there will be a company that will solve this issue. I said, probably it would be amazing. Some really smart people, probably from the USA, they will solve this. And then I thought, maybe I can be a part of this. And I sent an email to Impossible Foods telling them that they should work on 3D printed meat. And if they want to have a conversation, I would be willing to have this conversation. So they never replied, so I started a company instead. But the thing in this kind of journey, that suddenly you think about it all of the time. You really say, how would this company look like? How would the first PR look like? How would they raise money? All of the thing as somebody who's looking from the side. And then you need to develop this courage to say, I will be that person. If anybody can make it, it's me. Or if anybody is willing to try and maybe fail, it's me because it's going to be very interesting. And then I chose a deadline of myself, instead of having this obsession, hobby, reading in the night, talking with people. What is the deadline that I will give it a chance myself? And that was the day of the birth of my second son. I told my boss, I told him, I'm going to quit this great job and this great relationship we have to start my own thing when my second son will be born. And then I sent him a text message, I have a son, and bye-bye. And he was very, very kind about that. And he told me that this is what I should do. I have some nice quotes from him and other people that told me, go and make your dream come true, not other people's dream come true. And if anybody can do it, it's you. Or if anybody can be a lawyer with an MBA that is working on 3D printed meat, it has to be you. It wasn't easy. I had one very tough year emotionally, that you feel you're a failure. Because when you have a career, you want to be quite good, right? You want to succeed. You want to have a feeling that on your track. When you're an entrepreneur, you're constantly failing, constantly. And it's brutal, and it's personal, and it's quite painful. And the first year was really a year of not succeeding at all.
Hmm. So then at what point do you realize, you know, that you guys are turning a corner? And I guess before you even get there, why don't you just share with the audience what you guys are exactly doing at Redefine Meat so that they get it? What's the business model?
So we are a meat company. Today we're a meat company. We're developing, producing, and selling new meat products in 10 different countries. New meat is the next generation of meat because it has the same texture, flavor, nutritional composition as animal meat, but it's made using technology. And that technology is the technology that we developed. It didn't exist before Redefine Meat, that allows us to basically recreate the muscle structure of an animal. When you eat meat today, it doesn't matter what meat you eat the structure of the tissue of an animal, the muscle of an animal. And we develop plant-based tissue engineering. So we engineer the tissue from plants to recreate steaks, pulled meat, burgers. We developed those products and technology a few years ago. About 2 years ago, we launched them into the market. And now we are producing new meat in Israel, in the Netherlands, and selling it to restaurants, to food service operators, and to retailers across many, many countries. Some of them are vegans and vegetarians, but most of them are flexitarians, people that still eat meat but want to reduce, that usually never participated in what is called plant-based meat. For example, steaks. We're the first company in history that launched a steak to food service that is made from plants and not from animals. And we're continuing every 3 months to introduce new, better products to more and more consumers and more dining occasions based on technology, based on an incredible brand that addresses what meat eaters want, which is a lot of fun and a lot of challenges as well.
Well, talking about challenges, you were saying that the first year was not easy. So at what point do you guys realize that you're turning a corner and that you're into something here?
To be honest, it's when you raise money, because when you don't raise money, you feel first that you're a failure. You're constantly getting rejected, but you're not progressing. So you have a vision, you have an idea, you have a story, you even have a team. We had a small team of people that either worked for free, like my co-founder and I, or we paid them ourselves. When we started meeting with angels in Israel and we got the initial $200,000 and we went into an accelerator and we won, we had recognition. We had some external people that said, you're not idiots and you're not going to waste time and then go back to your day job. But we also had money to get a lab, for example, instead of working from my parents' garage. We had an ability to pay advisors that knows a little bit more than us on food technology. And it took 1 year. So it's, imagine spending 1 year with no money, with no external proof that what you're doing is going to work, beside your own belief that you have to do it. And then suddenly you come to a lab and you have 10 people and we're building machines and we have investors that are bringing their friends and people are writing about us in the news. I think the second shift happened when we tasted something and then I didn't sleep the whole night. I tasted something that said, okay, one day it will be amazing. It wasn't amazing, but I understood how this can become meat. And before that, you didn't have any way for me, emotionally, physically, to taste the future literally, to understand it will all be okay. And today we have a lot of these moments that things are tough and you're quiet, the plans change or the reality hits you in the face. And then we taste something and we say, okay, if we have that, if it's really in our mouth today, the rest will be easy. The rest will figure it out.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So you were talking about raising money. How much capital have you guys raised to date? And how has it been the experience of raising the money?
We raised $190 million, which is an amazing, amazing number. It's incredible. A lot of responsibility, a lot of money, a lot of responsibility, and a lot of people that are brilliant, that are smart, that had a lot of options and put their faith and their money in our hands because they think they can trust us. So it's really, really critical to respect that. For me, raising money is not something I like to celebrate. It's not a milestone. It's not an achievement. But it's critical. You cannot do what we're doing. Deep technology. We have a lot of patents, a lot of smart people building factories, building a brand without money. But our experience and this industry experience of raising money is very, very different in the timeline. We started raising money where it was extremely difficult. The industry that we are in, it was not sexy, not trendy, not in hype. People told me, you quit your job to do fake meat for vegans. Somebody even told me once, you quit your job to make a falafel. And I told her, we're making meat, we're going to change the world. There was no benchmark. No other company in this space raised money. It wasn't clear if it's going to be a big market. And in that period of time, we raised $6 million. That was the most difficult money we ever raised as a company, based on an idea, based on smart people that believe in a mission, that are working like crazy, without industry experience, without a PhD, without technology. That, I think, was the most difficult, and it took us the longest time. So the amount of time that it took us to raise this first $6 million, and by the way, they're the most transformational for a company. What we achieved from zero to the $6 million is incredible. And I think a lot of time I reflect back and I say it's amazing what you can do at this stage of a company. But most people give up before they raise the first $6 million. And then we had some nice things to show and we raised additional $29 million. Always the investors that invested in one round participate in the next round, including the angels, including the small investors, including the family offices. It's really important for us that they continue to do. And then when we were ready to have a business, we started to raise more serious capital. So it's very different, because when you have a business, we're selling products, We have customers. We have customers that really like us. We have numbers to show. We have actual proof that what we're doing is not just a dream. Then it's easier to raise money. It's easier, but it's a completely different experience. Your skill set is not my storytelling and the vision. It's what you're actually doing in terms of execution. And it's a completely different way of approaching. And on top of that, now we have a business, by the way, we have a great business. We're growing in massive pace, like a software company, but we're a food company. We have amazing customers, but the industry is less trendy now. So the discussion is not with investors that are interested in an industry and fell in love with the notion of saving the planet. It's with people that are looking for a great business, and they can look for a software great business and a food tech great business. But I think today, where it's more difficult to raise money for all investors, but especially for food tech investors, I have this memory of the first $6 million that were in a completely different age than the 20, 21 years of raising money.
So when it comes to vision then with raising money, because that's something that they're really betting on, you know, and vision obviously, you know, is applied to customers, to employees all across the board. If you were to, let's say, go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where ultimately, you know, the vision for the company, you know, is fully realized, what does that world look like?
Well, first, it's a very, very nice question, because I wish that I could never answer this question. A lot of people, they look at their startup or the business as a destination that they want to achieve. For me, it's a journey. And imagine in a world where I completed my journey in Redefined Meat as a person, as a company, as a mission, is very depressing. So basically, I want to die working for Redefined Meat. I know it won't happen, and I hope it will be a very, very long time from now. But the story that we have that is guiding me from day one is building the world's largest meat company. And it's very good because it helps me with the challenges that I talked about just now. Building the world's largest meat company is a journey of the next 20 years. So we put it roughly 2040. And that day, we did what we intended to do and we thought is impossible in every element of making it impossible. Developing the technology, developing the products, building the culture that will enable it to scale to 10 countries, then making it profitable in 10 countries, then expanding to every place around the planet, developing more technologies, reaching more consumers, impacting more the planet. And it will never end, because the world's biggest meat companies today are 50, 60, some of them 100 years old. So maybe my kids will work in Redefined Meat, but this is more the romantic view. I think if you look 6 years back, what we thought we can achieve, we achieved much more. So we achieved more than what we actually thought we're going to achieve. But it was a lot of things that we didn't even consider that were random, and one thing led to another, and we were naive, and things that we thought will be really tough turned out to be easy, and things that we thought would be easy turned out to be really tough. We thought we'll have a 3D printer in a butcher shop, okay? We didn't do it, so we don't have a 3D printer in the butcher shop, but we're selling to hundreds of butcher shops that we never thought would be realistic to sell to hundreds of butcher shops. But for me, seeing our products in households as an everyday brand, you're in New York, right? That we walk around the streets of New York with a t-shirt of Redefined Meat, and people stop me and say, wow, I really like your product. That's for us a symbol of we've arrived. We have it in Tel Aviv. In Tel Aviv, if you walk in the street of Tel Aviv with a t-shirt of Redefined Meat, you will have somebody coming to you and say, Redefined Meat, you really made an impact on my life. But we need to do it in New York and in Sao Paulo and in Tokyo and in basically everywhere around the world. So it will take a long time.
So I know that, you know, there's obviously a lot of risk, you know, on building a company like this, on building any startup, no? So I think especially for the people that are listening, how do you think about risk levels and how to deal with it, you know, in business and in life?
I think I'm addicted to risk. I think I'm a person, I don't do extreme sport, but I like to be in a status of risk, of being very afraid of a result. A lot of people, they want this confidence that I'm making the right decision, I'm not doing the risky thing. And I believe for some reason, they're always delusional. There's always a chance that what you think is the right decision will blow up in your face. You know, I'm also an Israeli, so we have this reflection of tomorrow might be the best day in my life, and tomorrow I might die. So it's extreme. And the reality is somewhere in between. So I choose to put myself and the company at a status of risk a lot, because I think incredible things can come out of it. And we have this way of living with this fact, because people in our supply chain, in production, they can't live in this, in the level of risk that I can. But I try to take on myself all of the risk, of the company as much as I can, to enable the company to do things that seem impossible while allowing a lot of failures. So it's not one thing that is very risky that might fail or might succeed and then it will kill the company. It's a lot of things. It's a lot of risk that we take. But because all the companies that I know, I don't know a lot of companies, you interviewed more companies than I know, sometimes they succeed and sometimes they fail. And I don't think there is a system. I don't think there is an algorithm. I think that if you do an interview about a company that is successful and I follow what I hear in this interview, it's like me following the footstep of somebody that won the lottery. They wore a red t-shirt the day that they won the lottery. I won't wear a red t-shirt, but they took a lot of risk. And some of the amazing things they tried to achieve manifested in reality. Because we have a steak that is served in restaurants. I never thought it's possible. And we had to take a risk. We had to take a risk. We had to hire a person and give him a chance to develop something. We had to launch a steak in a restaurant before the steak was ready. We had to give people samples of a product that wasn't good. We had to commit to deadlines and then figure out how we're going to meet them. And every time we did it, when things didn't work, we said, okay, it's a part of life. When they worked, there was this moment, okay, we are jumping ahead 10 years in a day. And only risk can get you that. But, you know, entrepreneurs, Israelis first and Israeli entrepreneurs, they're people that decided to take risk in life. And to live with risk, to live with a high level of risk. In my last jobs, I never had the risk of failure or making a huge mistake or being afraid of something. And today I have it. Today, not every day. In the beginning, it was every day. But once a week, I'm doing something that I'm afraid of doing.
So then imagine now that I put you to a time machine and I bring you back in time. And I put you, you know, next to that, you know, a child that was thinking about taking a leap of faith and doing something of your own. And let's say you were able to give that younger self one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I would say don't be hard with yourself, because this is the problem. The problem, we as entrepreneurs, we beat ourselves a lot and we don't have anybody telling us it's going to be okay. We're the people that is telling everybody. Imagine people that are founders, CEOs, they're telling their employees, their wife, their board, their investors, it's going to be okay. But then you don't know if it's going to be okay. And then you lose a lot of years of your life. You lose a lot. You lose a lot of hair. As you can see, you're under a huge amount of stress. You become not yourself in many other aspects of life, like with your kids, with your family, with your friends, with your parents. But it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. The second thing, I would do much more. So had I known where we are today, I would just do much more, because you need in the beginning to have much more faith. A lot of people told me that you cannot, as a founder, have any doubt of your success. You cannot have any, even speak in a way that implies that in your mind you think you're not going to succeed. And it's so true, because I'm not trying to cure cancer. I'm trying to build the world's largest meat company. It's tough, but it can be done. It definitely can be done. Somebody can do it. I can do it. There is no doubt about that. It might be hard. It might take longer than what we thought. There might be a lot of even years that are seemingly things are going to the wrong direction, but it can be done. So why not wake up in the morning and just say, I got this. Why say I'm doubting myself? Am I a good boss? Am I a good co-founder? Is my board happy with me? Do my employees feel the energy that I bring to them? Yes, because it's going to happen. It's going to be amazing. And everybody along the way is going to have a journey that they're going to tell their grandkids about, and books will be written about that. And that's the life that you need to bring to the job every day. This is your job. And you cannot, I didn't do it in the beginning.
Reminds me of the quote of Nelson Mandela. It always seems impossible until it's done. Eh? So
that's exactly. It.
So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
So my email is very simple. It's esh@redefineme.com, ESH. LinkedIn, Facebook, I'm very accessible. I love to hear ideas, opinion. The most interesting thing that I like people reach out to me about is what thing in meat they want Redefine Meat to develop. Because we can do basically anything. We just need to decide what it is that makes sense. And some people brought up some nice ideas along the way. Only in meat. We don't do fish and we don't do cheese. But meat from across the world. I don't know, Alejandro, what is your favorite meat?
I love filet mignon.
Okay, this we already have in progress and ready to launch. But I'll get one to you soon.
Amazing. Well, hey, Eshar, it's been an absolute pleasure and an honor to have you with us. And thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show with us today.
Thank you, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.